at, I'm going to read verses 17 through 22, Hebrews 11. There are some outlines that have been prepared and handed out. I hope that you have one. If you do not, raise your hand and we'll see that you get one. This will help you to follow along tonight. All right, I think we must be taken care of then. I'm going to begin at the 17th verse. By faith, Abraham, when he was tested, offered up Isaac. And he who had received the promises was offering up his only begotten son. It was he to whom it was said, "In Isaac your descendants shall be called." He considered that God is able to raise men even from the dead, from which he also received him back as a type. By faith Isaac blessed Jacob and Esau, even regarding things to come. By faith, Jacob, as he was dying, blessed each of the sons of Joseph and worshiped, leaning on the top of his staff. By faith, Joseph, when he was dying, made mention of the exodus of the sons of Israel and gave orders concerning his bones. Well, we'll trust the Lord by his Holy Spirit to bring this passage home to our hearts tonight. I had the opportunity to go to a graduation on Friday night, and we went out to the Sandy Creek High School graduation. Now, I'm fascinated by how the times in which we grow up, how they shape us. And I figured something out. I just figured it out in the last day or two. Jim, I'm getting some strange sounds up here, and it's not the voices of angels either. I'm hearing. I've got. You hear what I hear? Okay. All right. I was saying that I'm fascinated by the way in which we are shaped by the eras, the time, the decades in which we grow up. Those who've grown up in the 30s and the 40s and the 50s, you have some peculiar traits about you that mark you because of that time frame. The music, the world and life view that dominated at that time, the manner in which you look at your world has been affected by those years, by the cultural circumstances of that time. You know, and I figured this out as to what was going on at this graduation. I was encouraged by the fact that the salutatorian and the valedictorian both gave testimony to God in heaven, to the Word of God, and they wove into their brief speeches, I thought, some excellent statements regarding a Christian world and life view. They really did. But I guess because the music directors are now those who have grown up in their 60s, wouldn't that be about right? Those who are working in the choral departments and leading the band. The 60s generation has come of age, and now they've gone to college and they've found places, and those who are working in the high schools. That's the only way I could explain this. John Lennon seems to be quite popular. I talked to my brother this afternoon, and they had their graduation at the Franklin High School in Franklin, Tennessee, and they also had something from John Lennon, so I guess their choral director is a 60s kid. And this was the song that the choral group sang, and I'm sad to say that this is the kind of thing that tended to shape people in the 60s. And this was the chorus. The chorus sang this. You probably, those of you who are fans of the Beatles, you might be able to pick up the tune that goes with this. I won't dare hazard that. But imagine there's no heaven. It's easy if you try. No hell below us, above us, only sky. Imagine all the people living for today. Imagine there's no countries. It isn't hard to do. Nothing to kill or die for, and no religion, too. Imagine all the people living life in peace. Imagine no possessions. I wonder if you can. No need for greed or hunger. A brotherhood of man. Imagine all the people sharing all the world. You may say I'm a dreamer, but I'm not the only one. I hope someday you'll join us and the world will be as one. So Penn, John Lennon, and the choral group sang such a philosophy, a world and life view, which I'm thankful was somewhat contradicted by the salutatorian and the valedictorian. Shaped in the wrong way, I'm afraid, by the poetry of the Beatles and the others. You know, what are those things that have shaped your life and the way you look at your world? May I take you back across the bridge of time to the days of Abraham and Sarah? You know, their lives were shaped by something. Their lives were shaped by hope. Abraham and Sarah, faltering certainly at moments, but the overriding movement of their lives, you will have to say, was that it was shaped by the confidence they had in the faithfulness of God, that He was going to bring to pass the promise that He had given them concerning descendants. And there would be a son who would be born to them, and it would be through that unique son, the son of their own physical union, who would be the one through whom the promise would pass and the blessing would come to all mankind. As a matter of fact, though Sarah had laughed early on in that experience, you remember the laugh in the language of unbelief, that Sarah and Abraham did go on to name their son Isaac, and you know what that name means. He laughs. So the last laugh was in the laugh in the name that was given to Isaac. And Abraham and Sarah must have had overwhelming joy as they watched Isaac grow up. But don't we all parents love to watch the children grow up? And we say, he's got your smile, he's got your look, he's got your hands, he's got your hair, he's got your eyes. And I think Abraham and Sarah, in the words of one commentator put it this way, Abraham and Sarah would see aspects of their younger selves in their son. Perhaps Abraham's height and carriage and Sarah's stride and grace. So they would have seen all of that in Isaac. Now let's consider what that promise entailed. What was it that Abraham held on to so dearly and rejoiced so exuberantly, as well as Sarah, when they saw that Isaac was the one who had been promised? Because that promise of the land and the seed and the blessing would come to pass through this, their son, their unique son. And that land, seed, blessing promise given to Abraham was one that was going to eventually envelop the entire world. For I will bless what? I will bless those who bless you. I will curse those who curse you. And it was going to envelop us all. For there will come one day the seed of Abraham, Jesus Christ himself, who and whom we place our faith. And when we do, we then can become united with him in that blessing. And the promise becomes particularly ours, personally ours. I want to tell you this, that Abraham and Sarah's lives were shaped by a world in life view that was faith. And that's what I want us to pursue in the passage we look at tonight. Everyone here tonight has a world in life view. I would hope that it's Christian theism. I would hope that your world in life view, that you have the right answers to these five questions that every world in life view entertains, deals with, responds to. What is reality? You believe the reality is either God, gods, or solely a material world, solely a closed system. You also have a question to answer, must answer the question, who is man? You believe that either man is created in the image of God, or that man is a result of chance through time, or man is that he is simply chemistry. He is mechanical only in nature. You have a third question in your world and life view. Everybody has one now. You have a third question. What happens to man when he dies? What happens at death? Either we go back to the ground like the animals, or there is an eternity that we face, either in heaven or hell. And a fourth question that you and I have to work into our world and life, you or respond to, is what is the basis of morality? Is it the character of God, or is it the affirmation of man? And a fifth question in your world and life view is that what is the meaning of human history? Is it linear? Is it moving in a direction where it will be fulfilled under the sovereign controlling hand of God? Or is it cyclical? Or is it meaningless with no purpose other than we live out our lives by chance on this planet? We have, every one of us, a world and life view. And there are only two ways of looking at life, God's way and man's way. And that set of presuppositions with which we all operate should be informed and filled out by the Word of God to give us a world and life view that could be heralded as, in one word, faith. What I want you to look at in this passage tonight in verses 17 to 22 is that here is a world and life view that I choose to put in couch in these terms. Here are faith's values. We hear a lot about that today. Of what, you know, family values, what is your value system? We need to get back to traditional values. I bring something to that word values, and so I can use it, but, you know, I'm a little uneasy with it. Everybody's got values. You know, the issue isn't really returning to values. The issue is, what kind of values are you going to go to? Are you going to live by? Value, maybe the word virtue would be better. William Bennett suggests the word virtue in the place of value. But you understand, a value is one's ideals. It is that which the members of a society regard as desirable. I submit to you that there are four values that faith dictates that must be a part of a Christian's world and life view in this passage. The first of these is found in verses 17 through 19. And that value which faith gives to us to form a part of our world and life view is that faith faces tests by confidence in the faithfulness of God. Watch this. In each of these value statements, in this first one, I repeat it, faith faces tests by confidence in the faithfulness of God. Hope shapes the way in which you and I face a crisis. Hope. What we believe about the future, things to come. Look at the text with me, and I'll demonstrate this to you from this first episode. Verse 17. By faith, Abraham, when he was tested, offered up Isaac. Now, Isaac at this time, probably in his middle or late teens. And he, Abraham, who had received the promises, was offering up his only begotten son. I'm going to comment on that word in a minute and explain why it's so translated. It was he to whom it was said, "In Isaac your descendants shall be called." Let me pause there and point out something that's quite momentous about that statement in its context. In Isaac your descendants shall be called. Isaac, at the time that Abraham was taking him to offering, had not married. He had no children. There were no descendants. You understand the implications of this. If Isaac is the unique son through whom the promise would pass, the blessing upon whom the blessing would come, and did. If he has no heir, in other words, Abraham has no legitimate, according to the promise, grandson, we got a problem. Abraham had a serious problem. So, Abraham could not expect some other son to replace Isaac in the event that Isaac would be childless. You see, this looks like a dead-end street, folks. Let me put it another way. It would seem on the surface that a commandment of God is contradicting a promise of God. Or to put it another way, it would seem that the circumstances into which Abraham had stepped under the sovereign hand of God, God does rule over and bring to us the circumstances, it would seem that the circumstances contradict the promise of God. You keep that in mind. That's the essence of this test that Abraham has to deal with. Verse 19. He considered. I like that word considered. The Greek word here is logizomai. Logizomai, where logic comes from this word, logizomai. It's the word that one would associate with logical, analytical, deductive thinking. He considered that he thought this carefully, that God is able to raise men even from the dead, from which he also received him back as a type. What he did is that he made a deduction. That Abraham saw that God had called him into this test to offer up his own son, but believed that in the death of Isaac that God would bring him back from that death. You know what is recorded in John by Jesus in John 8 and 56? Your father, Jesus said this, your father Abraham rejoiced to see my day, and he saw it and was glad. What day did Abraham see? Abraham saw with the eye of faith, he saw the resurrection power of God, and it was in no grander way displayed than it was when Jesus Christ was raised from the dead. That's how he saw it, through the resurrection power of God, as he was anticipating it in the life of his own son, or the death of his own son, Isaac. I want to take you back now, and let's do just a little bit of analysis here of this episode, this test, and then we'll bring it on down to some shoe leather issues. What is the meaning of the word tested? We have to look at this word carefully. Pyrazo. It's capable of two kinds of meanings depending on the context, depending on usage. The word can mean, it's used in the sense sometimes of being tempted to draw out, to be faced with a sin. That is not the way it is used here. James 1 and 13, God tempts no one. He at no time seeks to draw us out to get us to sin. God, as it were, does not place a great cosmic foot before us to try to see that if we'll trip over it. God doesn't draw us out to sin. That's not the way it's used here. The point of the word here is that God arranged a trial to develop even greater trust in himself. God so set up the circumstances that Abraham was going to face, I think, the greatest trial that he faced in his life. And I might, let me stop and just mention this by way of application. As you grow in the faith and you go through trials and you go through difficulties, you may be tempted to think that as you get older, that somehow you might be able to coast a little bit. That tempting thought may fleet across the back of your mind. I'm here to say this not by way of pessimism, but by way of preparation for us all, that the Lord has the greatest tests before us. They're not behind us. He has faithfully been preparing us for those. I do not know what they are, nor do you. But Abraham faced the greatest of tests in the last years of his life. It may very well be that way for us. But look, here's another question. Why was this test of such great proportions to Abraham? Well, think about it. Well, one, it was his son. Take his son and offer him up as a sacrifice. There would be no greater pain in life, I cannot imagine any, than to have one's own child precede him or her in death. That's an unbearable pain. Secondly, the manner in which Isaac was to die, that he would be a burnt offering. He would be slain on that altar. His carotid would be cut. Throat, he would be killed, and he would be offered up. He was proceeding to go through that. The knife was poised in midair, and God stopped him. A ram had been placed in a bush not far away, which would be the substitute. And oh, what a beautiful picture of the substitutionary atonement of Jesus Christ right there in that Genesis 22 scenario where you see in the place of Isaac, there was that ram that was given to die. But here is the degree of the pain of this test. It was a challenge to the integrity of God's promise. God had said it would be through your seed you would have descendants. And it looked as if his seed was about to die. And yet he had no children. How do you understand? It looked like a contradiction. And then, of course, you have to consider this. God had already asked Abraham to walk away from his past when he left Ur of the Chaldees. Now he's asking him to surrender his future. What else do you have left? Well, God, I left the family. I left all of that. I'm here. And now you've given me your promise, but now it seems that you would take it away. So where my future seems to, a fog seems to be moving in on my future. I want to tell you this about the test, is that the very test that Abraham dealt with and struggled with here brings home to us some immediate lessons, one of which is the question to Abraham at this time was that could he trust God to do what was right in spite of all the circumstances? You and I will get put in that spot. You and I may be in that. You may be in it right now, where you are in the midst of a set of circumstances that seem to be contradictory to the very promises of God. Let's take one. All things work together for good to them that love the Lord and are the called according to His purpose. And you may have some painful situation, which for the life of you, you cannot see how this can be for good. It seems to scream to just the opposite conclusion. Let me suggest this to you as in answering this question. Asking the question first, what conclusion did Abraham draw with regard to Isaac's future? You can see that Abraham, in the midst of this test, just there is a great demonstration of faith. In what way? He is believing that God was going to resurrect Isaac. You look in the Genesis 22 passage, you can see him saying to the servants who've accompanied him to Moriah, the place of sacrifice, he said, "You wait here, and we, the lad and I, we will return to you." He was expecting them both to come back. Well, that was not glib optimism. That was a firm conviction that God knew what he was doing and that God was going to take care of bringing, or was going to bring Isaac back to life. He would resurrect him. So his love for God was demonstrated in a superlative way through this sacrifice, bringing Isaac to the Lord at this time. I submit to you also at this point that in a struggle that you have with God in circumstances, you ought to be thinking this way. And you know what Abraham did, and this is extraordinary, and you look at his faith, is that the problem was really God's problem. You know, Abraham doesn't seem to be struggling with that issue, does he? That, "Lord, I do not understand how this is going to mesh with what you're trying to do in my life, but that's your problem." I mean, he doesn't say it that way, but it was God's problem, and he was willing to leave it with God, but yet he knew that God was going to work through that and was going to do what was best. Parents, and I spoke to some parents this week who are going through some deep, dark waters, and it came home to me that this may very well be the kind of test they're going through, that a rebellious child, a child that you've nurtured and that you've loved and that you've taught and who's been to Sunday school and has listened and sat in the services of the church, and they have had this enormous, enormous legacy of biblical truth and the ways of God, and then they come to a point in their lives, perhaps late teens, maybe in their early 20s, and they suddenly go from a posture of apparent submission to a posture of insolence and hardness and rebellion. Oh, the parents that I talked to this week, their hearts were broken. It seemed that this child of theirs was climbing as high as he could up Fool's Hill and was just repudiating what he had heard, what he knew, what he really had heard to be truth. That would seem to be a contradiction. "Lord, we've reared our child. We've taught this child. I don't understand how this fits in. Oh, God, I want to show my love by trusting you. I want to show my love to you by trusting you in this test. I don't understand why this set of circumstances exist. But, Lord, I'm going to demonstrate my love for you, but because I'm going to trust you and walk through this." That was that kind of faith. I submit it to you this way. Why and how does God send tests into our lives? Well, they reveal how much do we trust God. How much do we? We may find that our trust is perhaps more one of convenience than it is really a life of commitment. Much of our service of the Lord may be because due to the circumstances, it's been relatively easy. But now we're faced with something where it's really going to cost us something. You know, we ought not to think simply in terms of loss, but we ought to think in terms of gain. Sometimes the Lord will send us a test and He will give us a promotion, give us a better job, He'll give us more income, maybe give us an inheritance, some windfall. What do we do with that? Does it reflect itself in the way we give and respond to the work of God? I want to go to a second value. Faith has values. If you form your world and life view, faith should shape the way you face tests, by confidence in the faithfulness of God. Notice in the 20th verse that faith transfers God's promises from one generation to the next. Look at the 20th verse. I put it in these and try to state it in this term, in this proposition. Hope shapes the way in which you and I are to think about our children. Look at verse 20. By faith Isaac blessed Jacob and Esau, even regarding things to come. You ought to underscore that, things to come, because that's the operative phrase in this entire section. That the confidence in what each patriarch knew about things to come dictated the way in which they handled their immediate circumstances. That was the North Star. The North Star, that reference point for their compass in life, was things to come. What God was going to do in the future. And that though they even may not, they would not see portions of it in this life, they knew that they would be with God, He would fulfill His promises, that city to which they were journeying, it dictated the way in which they made their decisions, handled their present circumstances. Now, look at this verse carefully. Where it says that by faith Isaac blessed Jacob and Esau. This is an amazing thing the writer of Hebrews goes to Isaac. And picks up Isaac as an example of faith. I don't know that I would have done that. I'll tell you why. When I look at Isaac in the Bible, and I see kind of a passive, at best, a passive faith. Isaac is typical of second generation believers. I say it doesn't have to, maybe I should qualify that. You don't have to be this way if you're a second generation believer. But it seems to often happen this way. Let me explain what I mean. Do I have you here? Here is Abraham. Here's Sarah. And the extraordinary faith in which they placed in God. Now here's Isaac. He's a man that just seems to be very quiet and placid. And so much so that I think having been familiar with the things of God and the promises of God, that you don't see these exploits of faith like you see in Abraham's life, nor even that you can see in Jacob's life. And Isaac is rather placid in his faith. And he tries, his intention was to bless Esau. I mean, look in that home. This ought to encourage you, for those who look upon, maybe you've come from a home that's dysfunctional. You want to think about some dysfunctional elements in a home. Here is Isaac, and there is Rebecca, and there is Jacob, and there is Esau. Think of the different agendas that everybody had in that family. Isaac doted on Esau. I mean, Esau was Isaac's favorite. He was an outdoors guy. He was a good old boy. I think if you put him into contemporary description, he'd be riding around in his pickup with his skull cup in his back pocket, and he'd have a dip, and he'd get a scholarship and maybe play fullback at the University of Georgia. He's just a good old boy. And everybody would love that's Esau. That's Esau. And Jacob. Now, Jacob was no wimp. But Jacob was a big, I think Jacob was a big, strong guy. He goes up to that well, moves that stone, impresses all the girls, and he is, but Jacob is one that not only is physically strong, and I don't think he could probably have whipped Esau in a fight, in a wrestling match. I think he might have could have held his own. But Jacob, I want to be fair with Jacob. I know he comes across as kind of a crook, and he is manipulative, he's deceptive. But you know the thing about Jacob? is that Jacob had a desire that the purpose of God be fulfilled. Now, he didn't go about it the right way a lot of times. And as the Lord worked in his life, he came to some real expression of faith. We're going to see that in the next example. And the word of God meant something to Jacob. That's the difference between a Jacob and an Esau. That's the difference between a man of faith and a good old boy. Good old boys don't necessarily care about what the word of God really means. They just want to fit in and be nice and have a good time. They think about their stomach. They think about their appetites. But I'm going to tell you, one has a worldly life view that's shaped by hope is one who sees the word of God as important and that they want to fulfill that. Now, let me get you back to Isaac. Isaac doted on Esau. Rebekah, she favored Jacob. He even worked in complicity with him to deceive Isaac. Esau, angry, vengeful, wanted to kill his own brother. Jacob the deceiver, talk about some dysfunctional characteristics in a family. But you know what's extraordinary? Hebrews, by the Spirit of God, looks into that family and sees that there was an expression of faith there. Let me show you this in this way. Here, Isaac and Rebekah knew that the promise to Abraham was to continue through Jacob. Yes, they did know that. Though Isaac sets out to put the blessing upon whom? Esau. God, in his providence, so rules even over connivory. He so rules over deceit and manipulation. You remember the story. Time won't allow us to go back through all of the details of the story. But Jacob or Rebekah, they find out that there is this blessing that Isaac is going to give to Esau. Jacob comes in pretending he is Esau. He comes in and he's got the smell of the outdoors, and he brings that nice stew in, and Isaac puts the blessing upon Jacob, not upon Esau. Well, this is where it should go to begin with. God, you overruled that and directed that blessing to come upon Jacob. Let me take it a little bit further and show you what I mean in these terms. That the question I propose is, what did Isaac receive from his father and also wanted to give to his children? Isaac gave the blessing. Look in Genesis, don't turn there, but mark it down, Genesis 27:33. Twice it says this. It's a very strong affirmation. Yes, and he shall be blessed. The issue is this. How must we think about our family when it comes to the promises of God? What God showed to Isaac. Oh, and there's another lesson here, and I wish I had time to play with it for a little while. Let me take maybe a minute to point it out. That I have a question to propose even before that question. How are we to respond when we have done something plainly wrong? Isaac did something plainly wrong. Isaac was intending to put the blessing upon Esau, upon whom it should not have gone, to whom it should not have gone. What do we do when we've done something plainly wrong? Learn a lesson here, because guess what? We all do things plainly wrong. We get out of line. We sin. We disobey. But Isaac's faith broke through here. Watch this. Isaac's faith broke through. He dealt with that disobedience, and he did not withdraw the blessing that he had pronounced upon Jacob. Because I think it came home to him that what had happened, what had happened was that what should have happened under the right circumstances. Isaac submitted to the will of God. He said, and I quote that passage again from verse 33 of Genesis 27. Yes, and he shall be blessed. That's what he said about Jacob. I think he was caught right there in that spot. Yes, and he shall be blessed. Isaac then was submitting to the will of God. Esau now didn't accept it. You know that sad story. Esau really was angry, wanted to kill. He was vengeful. You have other examples of this, and this is a mark of a man or woman of faith. Peter is an example. When he failed, he came back, he got up, he went on. David is an example of this. How did these people handle their sin? That even when you fail and fall into sin, that's an opportunity to exercise faith. Do you see that? You don't have to be written off as a loser and it's all over. You simply come back, and even dealing with the fallout in the aftermath of your own disobedience, get yourself up and express faith in the way you handle it. Lord, I've sinned against you, and now by your grace, help me to deal with that which has come because of the consequences of that, and I'll proceed with you. Do you think that way about your own failure and your own fall? That it's the occasion to learn obedience to God even at that moment. Now, that's a world in life view that shapes you, even when you fail. Because some of you may have written yourself off because, you know, I failed the Lord and it's all over. Well, Isaac was one who came back and expressed faith even in disobedience. Now I want to come to another question. How must we think then about our family when it comes to the promises of God? I see in Isaac here something exemplary. Hope is shaping the way in which he related to his children, Jacob and Esau. Hope, therefore, should shape the way in which I deal with my own children, my own family. You and I must think intergenerationally when we think about the promises of God. How can I pass along to my own children that which is important in terms of the promises and the standards and of the world and life view of a Christian? The sad thing in our day is what's happened in our own homes, and I'd like to, let me just give you a little hot foot here for a moment. This is for all of us. This is something that came to my attention. It comes from Christianity Today, and it's an editorial, and the title of which is "The Fall and Rise of Marriage." And this is a response to the report on the Council of a report by the Council on Families in America, entitled "Marriage in America." And this report is viewed by this, the individual who's writing this, is that there is some optimism now. Even those who are some of the movers, the shakers, the thinkers, the planners, the sociologists, and so on, they're seeing that we're dying, or a dying culture. The editorialist says this: "We as a society are simply failing." Excuse me, the report comes to this conclusion. "We as a society are simply failing to teach the next generation about the meaning, purposes, and responsibilities of marriage." Did you get that? Now, this is a report from these are not believers. This is not a gathering of evangelicals to forge a statement on the family. "We as a society are simply failing to teach the next generation about the meaning, purposes, and responsibilities of marriage. If this trend continues, it will constitute nothing less than cultural suicide." There's some other good statements in there, but I want to say this, put it in these terms. My belief in things to come should dictate my plans for my children's future. And the way in which I should be relating to my children, coming back to something so simple and elementary, but fun, so critical in looking and overseeing the lives of my children, that I'm praying and working and doing everything I can so that they may come to a knowledge, saving knowledge of Jesus Christ. I want that, and I want that more than anything else. You know who I offer you from church history as an example of this? And God honored her prayers and worked through her. You remember the name Monica? Monica? Does this ring a bell? Monica. When you think of Monica, think of Augustine, her son. And this woman was apparently the only believer in a pagan home. Well, what we know about her husband and the background and her own background, because she's been given a name of a Punic god, she probably grew up in a pagan home in North Africa in the 300s A.D., and this woman became a believer, and the only believer in that pagan home. And when her sons were born to her, she began to pray for their salvation. And one son she noted and followed him. She followed him even as he was an unbeliever and was going up through the ranks. He was a great rhetorician, a great lawyer, a brilliant mind, but he didn't know the Lord. He was seeking error in a philosophy called Manichaeism. Make a long story short, you know who it was. She prayed, and that Man, that was Augustine, one of the greatest theological minds in the history of the church, and has shaped the way we think about theology, and has shaped the form and the fashion of church history. She prayed for him. You may have an Augustine in your home, you never know. Or an Augustina, whoever. And you and I should shape the way in which we approach the rearing of our own children. And don't let the failures and the sins of your children cause you to write them off and give up on them. You know, that's easy for a parent to do. Isaac looked right through that shattered vase of life before him with the favoritism and all that was going on and the jockeying for the best position. And yet he said, yes, and he will be blessed. He wouldn't let go of that fact that there is a future to be realized with God through this son, through Jacob. Now, parents, I want to encourage you. You may have a child that's climbing up Fool's Hill. Don't write them off. Don't give up on them. But enter into their lives, and by the grace of God, bear with great patience that you seek to shepherd them along and to be there and direct them in the place through which you can leave them the best thing that you could ever leave them. The legacy of witness, the knowledge of Jesus Christ. Well, let's go to a third faith principle, another value. Thirdly, faith does not allow age to diminish its activity. Look at the 21st verse. By faith, Jacob, as he was dying, blessed each of the sons of Joseph and worshiped, leaning on the top of his staff. Well, I have to make one correction. Some of you, if you were look back in your Old Testaments and you would look at that word staff, you will see as he's leaning on the top of his bed. Well, let me give you about a 15-second explanation. The Hebrew word is translated both staff and bed, is made up of three consonants. Depending on the vowel pointing, it can be either staff or bed. Septuagint, the Greek translation of the Old Testament, saw the correct word here as staff, not bed. The point is this. Here is Jacob, old, in his dying moments. He is leaning in an act of worship on the top of his staff. He's so frail and almost out, so far gone, he has to have a prop. And he worships and expresses this faith. I submit to you that the proposition here is this. In a world and life view wherein faith shapes us, faith will shape, and the hope that shapes us is that hope shapes the way in which we grow old and the way we deal with our frailty and deal with our limitations. In Jacob's dying hours, he did not waver in the belief that the promises of God would be fulfilled to his posterity. Jacob, though he was getting frail, he was getting weak, though he was almost ready to step out and into the presence of the Lord, I'll couch it in a question. What do we notice about Jacob in his dying hours? His physical weakness did not stop him from worshiping. He did not waver in his faith. And so I propose by way of an application question, how can you and I express faith to the very end of our lives? You have to have a pilgrim mentality right to the very end. And in so doing, you will make decisions to impress upon others things to come. Jacob in his dying days is so convinced of things to come, the future with God, that he is... You have to understand exactly what's transpiring in that story to appreciate what Jacob was doing. Joseph brought two sons to him. Joseph's two sons. You remember those two? Ephraim and Manasseh? Now they are going to get a share of the blessing that came to the firstborn. Because Reuben, as well as Simeon, but Reuben the firstborn had taken himself out of the first portion of the inheritance by his own sinfulness. Joseph brings his two sons, born to him, to his wife, in Egypt, Manasseh and Ephraim. They stand there before him. Joseph places Manasseh at the right hand of Jacob. He places Ephraim at the left hand. You know why? Because Manasseh is the older of the two. And he's expecting there to be an immediate, the blessing to come down upon his right hand, which be symbolically the way in which the blessing, the promise was transferred. But though Joseph tries to guide his hands upon those heads in that way, do you know what happens? Jacob takes his right hand and goes over here and puts it on the head of Ephraim, and takes his left hand and puts it over here on the head of Manasseh. And in crossing over, he focuses on the fact that the promise is going to go to Ephraim. Ephraim is going to become the dominant tribe in the northern tribes, a dominant tribe in Israel. The blessing is focused upon that son, on Ephraim, not on Manasseh. I'm telling you that the way Jacob is thinking in his dying days is this. He's thinking of the significance of the promise and how specific it is, and that it must be focused on the right one. He is so consumed with his belief in things to come that he's going to see that it goes not whimsically, not carelessly, but that it's going to focus and bear in on the one to whom the blessing should come. The principle, beloved, is this, that as we come to older years, now, I'm not speaking to all the audience on this, at least immediately. Let me just have the ears of everybody 45 and above. The others, you can break this down and put it in layaway. But I'm telling you, and you'll need this, playing with you a little bit here, that what you need to remember, that as you and I come into older years, the graying of the head and frailty and weakness, and as we begin to die in a more demonstrable fashion, we're all dying. Do not allow that frailty and weakness in those dying days to diminish your focus upon God and your being consumed with things to come, and that you're going to touch lives. You know, one of my concerns of Baraka as a church as we age, that's happening here at Baraka. One of my concerns, and I'm dealing with myself on this as well, is that as you get older, you tend to get just a little bit careless about things. That's a temptation. You want to ease back. You think, well, I've earned my stripes. I've put in my time. I've done my duty. I've made the sacrifices. I think that I'll just let the pedals go around without my feet. And you know, you can get into some real trouble. Have you ever tried that, going down a hill on a bicycle? Don't try it. Try to get your feet back on the pedals once those things really get going. I am challenging you with this danger, that as an aging church, and it is, as we get older, that the danger of becoming apathetic about things to come, and church and our Christianity is reduced to simply coming and going and sitting in the service, hurrying out to get to our meal so we can get in our best chair and take our little snooze and get back up and come to the service and hear the message and enjoy, go home, watch a little bit of TV, eat some potato chips, go to bed, get up, and we end up and we don't reach out to anybody, we run and we exit and we leave and we lose contact with people and we're not involved, and the promise of God has diminished before our eyes because we're not effectively involved in the lives of people when we've gotten older. Watch it. It's a danger. There's Jacob leaning on his staff, worshiping God, and I've got to get the blessing in the right place. Don't let it happen. Conclusion. Faith faces death by the promises of God. Them bones. Godfrey, you got a song, them bones, and dry bones. Well, this is the bones passage. Look at the text. Look carefully. By faith, Joseph, when he was dying, made mention of the exodus of the sons of Israel and gave orders concerning his bones. Joseph, extraordinary expression of faith. This man, and oh, I like Joseph for a number of reasons, but here's one I'll tell you about. That Joseph's extraordinary faith is that here he was, a victim in his own family, having lost time with his family, the influence of Egypt, he was treated poorly by his brothers, and yet it all was the means of developing his faith and confidence in God, not diminishing it, and he tried to find no excuse in it. There are some of us, we just look for every excuse that we can get because somebody did to me, what they are doing to me, and because they're doing that to me, I can't do this, I can't be that. And you see just the opposite in Joseph, who's shaped by this kind of world and life view. I put it this way. Hope shapes the way in which you and I approach our death. And Joseph wants this to be a certainty when it comes to his own body. That he wants his mummified body, And don't forget this. Joseph could have, as prominent as he was, he could have guaranteed him the most impressive burial in an imposing tomb. He could have had one of those pyramids. You remember the pyramids? He could have had one. But what he chose was this. I want you to take my mummified body, and I want you to be sure that when you go out, and Moses kept the fulfill this. It was carried out in Exodus chapter 13, 19, when Moses led Israel out of Egypt. He carried the mummy, and Joseph's bones went with him, as well as Jacob. And they carried him because he wanted his bones to be up there in Canaan. Why? He believed that there was a future for God's people in Canaan, not in Egypt. And he believed it so intensely, and he was so convinced of it, that, as I will show you now, that Joseph's burial then becomes an expression of his faith in God. He knew where he belonged, and it was in the land of promise. And I want to hurry to this conclusion and application. How can you plan your funeral to reflect your belief in things to come, like Joseph did? The belief in the promise. Well, you and I can do this. Number one, make sure your life's a message, so that the preacher doesn't have to get up there and be tempted to be a liar in order to make you look good. Now, a preacher's worth his salt is going to think carefully, and twice he's going to be very carefully how he presents the person. But I have been to funerals where when that preacher, when he got through, and what I knew about that person in that coffin, there was no resemblance whatsoever. Give the minister, give the family, give people a message, and that it can be one that speaks to the promise, and that you believed in things to come. And you know, I can say this also. Make sure that you construct your will in your funeral service to reflect your belief in things to come. What about your will and where your money and your inheritance goes? What little it may be. I think that more Christians ought to think in terms of leaving it to Christian ministries and where it can be useful, and rather than let it be squandered by those upon whom it would be wasted. And make sure that your funeral service itself will be one. Write it out. If you haven't done it, plan it. We never know when we're going. And get it ready so that it will reflect your belief. What? That your bones will be a very testimony to God and His power to fulfill His promises. Godfrey, can we have a song in conclusion tonight to these four faces of faith and the way we're to live out faith in our life? Give us a benediction, please.
I have asked him, Howard, to do two numbers.
All right.
Please.
All right. And you're on, Godfrey.